John Dickerson is moderator of CBS's Face the Nation and political director of CBS News, as well as being a columnist for Slate magazine. In the 2016 election cycle, he has interviewed every major candidate multiple times and was the chief moderator of CBS's Democratic and Republican primary debates. He's been a reporter in Washington for almost 20 years, covering the White House, Congress, and political campaigns. Before joining Slate, Dickerson was with Time magazine for almost 15 years. His last 4 years, he was the magazine's White House correspondent, covering the presidency of George W. Bush. In his new book, Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History, he tells the stories behind the stories of the most memorable and forgotten moments in American presidential campaign history. It is a great pleasure to welcome John Dickerson to the roundtable this morning. John, thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me, Joe.
Well, it's very nice to have you on the program, and I'm a big fan of your work, so it's especially nice to have you. The obvious question, the first one that I have to start out with, is I would think as a political journalist, either this year is just like Christmas every day, or there's a point where you start to second guess your profession.
I think it's the latter.
Really?
Because you know, a lot of the twists and turns, I mean, covering twists and turns is interesting. That's what news is. News is what surprises us. So in a sense, we have a bounty of that. You know, covering campaigns in general, so the first campaign I really covered fully was 1996. And there's just the campaigns have changed. They become coarser. The news cycles are faster. There's more kind of shiny object coverage. And it's hard to get a fix on where the campaign is, which leads to a certain sense of uncertainty and old rules not applying, which is exciting in a sense. But it's also exciting in the same way, you know, having a loose wheel on your car is exciting. It's destabilizing. And I think because the destabilization is both created by and exacerbates underlying anxiety in the country, there is an ominousness to the campaign that doesn't feel great. So it's hard to it's really hard to think of this as an enjoyable. I think most political journalists would like to see a battle of ideas by two candidates who believe in sort of running races in the old way, which is you present a reasoned argument full of facts, and then you kind of let everybody figure out what's better. I say the old way. Actually, that's not actually how lots of campaigns have been run, more like the one we're having now than what I just described. But that's a more kind of pleasant process than what we're going through now.
I do want to get into that old way and what you just mentioned, which is the meat of the book, and we'll get into that in a moment. But political ideology aside, I mean, you just recently interviewed President Obama. That's a very different experience than interviewing a candidate such as Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump.
Right. I mean, just at the very basic level, when you interviewed candidates, it's about conflict. It's about confrontation and choices. They are always thinking, in whatever I say, can I take something away from my opponent? Can I make myself look better relative to my opponent? Presidents have to think more about compromise, more about a bigger set of issues, and they're not always trying to be confrontational. That's not to say, of course, that President Obama hasn't had and isn't always thinking about confrontation, either with the Republicans in Congress or the party more broadly or the party's nominee in Donald Trump. But you can have a conversation that's not fully combative in the way you do with a campaign. And you can do, in the interview I did with him, the attempt was to find out what attributes and skills are at the heart of the presidency, regardless of who wins. What are they going to need to know? What are they going to be tested on? I don't mean specifically, but I mean their character traits that are going to be challenged by the job. And what do we then, using that knowledge, what do we then go look for in a campaign to make sure that our candidates are going to have some shot at doing the office well?
I am curious as to how you react to various news outlets, and I'll mention the Washington Post as the biggest example of writing a full-page editorial of saying, look, Donald Trump, this man is not fit to be president, which is a debate that we're continuing to have. Do you feel at all, or have you personally felt, that you have a responsibility to share that with your viewers in what you do as well? Or is there still that sense of, okay, we're going to present this to the American people and they will decide for better or worse?
Well, I think both can be the case. I think I'm much more of a present this to the American people, but I think that you can do it critically, which is to say, you're not just a conveyance for their talking points. So what you do is you try and figure out in your conversations with candidates or in your coverage, what's the standard for the office? What's the standard for the conversation? And by that can mean standards of behavior, standards of facts, the context in which a conversation takes place, if it's about a policy issue. So what's the framework in which the activities that are happening before us are taking place? And then how do those measure against that framework? And candidates rise and fall within that. And so if you're talking about the aptitude for the office, we're having a debate now initiated in part by Democrats who would like this to be the conversation, but also because Donald Trump, and I'm talking now about the question of temperament, Donald Trump's advisors say the big hurdle for him is whether people think he has the temperament for the job. And if he can clear that hurdle, the Trump people think that because elections are often about change and he's the candidate more associated with change, if people feel comfortable handing him the office, then, you know, then that's all basically he has to do. He'll win the election because he's represents more change than Hillary Clinton. So if it's a conversation about temperament, what does that mean? What is that? And how have the things he's done played into that question? That is, at the moment, not a great conversation for Donald Trump to be participating in because he's shown some intemperate responses, particularly to the families of a dead American soldier. So that's not, you know, so that's trying to tee up the choices, and then voters can make their determination. They can either decide temperament doesn't matter. They can decide that temperament of the kind Donald Trump has is precisely the kind they want because we've had enough failure as a result of too many niceties, and Donald Trump's maybe coarser but more direct approach is what America needs. It's still, in the end, people's choice and decision, and they have to engage in the process constantly and not let, you know, and not hope that basically the press is going to do it for them. They have to be an active partner in this.
On a competitor on the Sunday News shows, George Stephanopoulos interviewed Donald Trump. I've watched this interview, and I'm certainly not pitting the two of you against each other in any way, shape, or form. This is strictly a diagnostic question. But is there anything you would have done differently in that situation when you have someone who clearly does not seem to have the facts in his possession and allowing the candidate to almost inform them of their mistake, but then still allow them to go on whatever path they're going to go on?
Well, I think without talking about that specific interview, I can talk broadly about the challenge of interviewing any candidate and then particularly the challenge of interviewing Donald Trump. So what happens when you, in any given interview, you have X amount of minutes. And then in that X amount of minutes, you've figured out you've got, let's say, 10 questions. So you get an answer to your first question, and then you have to decide, do I follow up on that question or do I move on to the next one? Now, any question can be followed up on. That's not the question. The question is, is the follow-up going to be profitable for your viewing or reading audience in such a way that it makes it worth knocking off another one of the numbers down on the list? Is following up going to take you down a rabbit hole in which actually viewers will be more confused than illuminated? And by the way, you've also knocked off the questions that are further down your list. In any conversation, you're making those split-second decisions. And so there are often times where a candidate will say something and you could correct them, you could challenge them on it, but it's not as important as the thing you're then moving. You want to get to later, which will be perhaps more illuminating to the viewers. Furthermore, there are a lot of candidates who are practiced now in saying things that they know will elicit a response or a follow-up. And then they give an answer that's just another version of their talking points. And now they've eaten up half the interview, basically as a forum for their talking points. There's a third kind of candidate who knows that when they say something wrong, that you, in fact-checking what they've said, will convey their misinformation because there will be some number of people who will hear the fact check and not listen to the fact check, but will listen to the initial claim. And therefore, they found in some analysis that if a candidate says, the following is the case, and you say, well, no, it's not, that some people will hear you fact-checking them, but some people will hear the first thing that was said. So in your fact-check, you're actually helping carry along the original misinformation. All of that's got to go on in your head while the clock is ticking. So it's a little bit more of a complicated dance, and Donald Trump adds even new complexities in the ways that he answers things, in the ways he changes his mind sometimes in the middle of an answer. So that's something that's kind of what it's like when you're in the middle of one of those interviews.
John Dickerson is our guest, moderator of CBS's Face the Nation and author of the new book Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. Why did you decide to tell such stories?
Well, first of all, they're just exciting stories, you know, that have a narrative arc, a rise, a fall, fortunes change. There are lots of emergency decisions made under sweaty conditions. So they're just plain old good stories. But for me as a journalist, what I've done in the 25 years I've been covering campaigns is you're watching a campaign and you want to know, how is this different? How is it the same? History gives you some inkling of what might happen because of what's and how it's happened in the past. And it also, if it doesn't give you a template for what's about to happen, it gives you a way to look at what's happening and say, aha, that's what's new. This is not just the predictable response to this set of phenomena that we've seen throughout history, but this is what's new and worth paying attention to, and why is it worth paying attention to? What makes it new? And so it's the best, you know, in addition to the reporting you do about what's happening on the ground, what's happening in the race itself, history provides a nice context. So I've over the years just read about past races and collected these stories in one form or another, and then I started a podcast where I told some of these stories. People really seemed to like them, and so I thought, okay, well, now I'll do the harder business of going from, you know, riffing about these stories to actually trying to put them down in a way that puts them in historical context, that gives more color and life to the stories. And I keep finding, you know, echoes of lots and lots of these races in the race we're in now.
I was fascinated by how you decided to break up the book. It is not in chronological order. Instead, you break it up into seven parts, including things like comebacks and collapses and too close to call and crashing the party. What brought you to put it in those categories?
You know, I think as I was covering this campaign or just thinking about, you know, the kind of different elements of campaign coverage, those were the, you know, I kind of looked, sort of made the list of all the stories, and then with Sean Desmond, the editor at 12, kind of put together we realized they sort of fell in these categories. These are the kind of big turning point moments. Again, when you think about the narrative of a campaign, one of the things that makes it exciting is there are forcing moments. There are, you know, primaries which force a person to either disappear, meet expectations, and rise, or, you know, not meet expectations and disappear. Conventions used to, not as much anymore, but when there was really things at stake, those were turning points in the history of parties. Collapses, of course, that makes that's sort of self-explanatory in politics, when people make a choice and it really just totally ends their career or begins the ending. So it was really just thematic. If you had to just lay the stories all out and group them, these were the buckets we put them in.
You tell the story about Michael Dukakis and the tank.
Yeah. So the Michael Dukakis and the tank story. Part of what happened with this book, too, is that you had a notion sort of at first blush what that story was about, right? Which is they make a bad PR move and he looks funny and people laugh at him. I think it's about a couple of other things, too. I think, and this is when you go back and look at it, what it becomes about. I mean, partially what it's about, if you really want to pull back, it's about masculinity and presidential campaigning. Michael Dukakis was running against George Bush, who until... who had a big problem with what they called the wimp factor.
Right.
And that was the idea that he just wasn't sort of man enough for the job. So that's been a theme throughout American presidential history that candidates are referred to in terms of their manliness for the job, which tells us something about the sort of action emphasis we put on the presidency. And Kennedy and Eisenhower both complained about this kind of bias for action in the presidency, and certainly Barack Obama talks about it too. But you have to be seen as a kind of John Wayne character in the presidency. And so that was part of what that was about. Bush staged essentially a fight with Dan Rather to show that he had the mettle for the job, because Newsweek had run a cover story in which they had as the tagline the wimp factor. He was also trying to get out from under Ronald Reagan's legacy. He needed to show that he was his own person. And that's essentially what Dukakis was trying to do. This is about the symbols of campaigning and how they can overtake a candidate. But it was also the 1988 race about a systematic attempt to tear down Michael Dukakis. This was not a building up of George Bush's proposals. And it's there are echoes of our current campaign where both Clinton and Trump are basically just trying to tear down the other. And that they see the route to victory as being disqualifying the other. And the Bush campaign set out with Lee Atwater, gave his research director a 3x5 card and said, I want you to find the most important issues with this candidate, Michael Dukakis, and I want you to be able to fit it on this card, and that's what we're going to go attack him on. And they basically did that. They went through a point-by-point plan of making him seem out of the mainstream. Whether it was the fact that he was a card-carrying member of the ACLU, that he was weak on defense, that he had didn't seem to care enough about the flag and the Pledge of Allegiance, and this was an attempt to basically make him look unfit for the job as a character question, too liberal. And what Dukakis was doing in that tank was trying to respond to that, and it's about how campaigns respond, and sometimes in their response can end up doing themselves in. Michael Dukakis tried and was probably one of the last candidates, although you could argue that John Kerry learned this lesson again too. But Dukakis was trying to say, let's have an ideas campaign. Stop talking to me about the flag and talk to me about healthcare, which is goes back to my earlier description of what campaigns should be like and why how they should be isn't ultimately how they sometimes are. He tried to stay on the high road, and basically they let his opponent define him. Now we have campaigns in which nobody lets anyone define them for a nanosecond. What that means is you have constant states of warfare. And I say the exception to that a little bit might be when John Kerry, when the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth attacked his military record, there was seen as his response was slow, and that ended up hurting his campaign. That's some of what the Dukakis and the tank story is about, which is about more than just simply, you know, a photo op that people giggled at.
You write in that section not only about that, but Howard Dean, and you write about the race with Muskie, and as well as the McGovern-Eagleton race. I find it interesting because one of the things that seems very clear in this campaign is that Donald Trump has made misstep after misstep after misstep, and nothing yet, as of the taping of this interview, has caught to the point of a disastrous effect. Now, we're very early in the running of the general campaign, but I'm curious to see how you feel about the resilience of this particular candidate, or have we seen that too in our history?
It's a really good question. It's kind of the question at the center of the race at the moment. Resilience. I, at the moment, can't think of a candidate who has gone through as many blows as Donald Trump has and has seemed to stay alive for as long as he has. And I think the closest I can think of has been in the election of 1884. You had Grover Cleveland versus James G. Blaine. Both of them had big issues. Cleveland had fathered a child out of wedlock, and James G. Blaine had a whole host of scandals that he was associated with, most notably one having to do with railroad bonds and basically getting paid back for helping the railroad companies out. Two candidates in which people basically said what's now commonplace but wasn't so commonplace then, which is that you had to pick between the lesser of the two evils. Those were campaigns in which you had kind of constant problems and issues. I think So with Donald Trump, I think the question really is, it has to do obviously with the weakness of Hillary Clinton as a candidate, the absolute fury in the base of the Republican Party with its elites, and the feeling that Donald Trump is finally a champion for a group of voters who feel like they've never been listened to, and that gives them a durable affection for him. The fact that the elites are the ones who complain about what he's doing, which makes his supporters think, well, if it's making them angry or making them tut-tut, then he must be doing something right. So also his durability is quite mixed. So he's got about 40% maybe of the electorate, but he's also 7 in 10 people have an unfavorable view of him. His only about 34% of the people think he's honest. 6 in 10 don't think he's qualified for the job. So he's got some pretty bad numbers. Hillary Clinton is ahead with college-educated white voters, which is the normally a group that Republicans have won in every election since they've been measuring it in 1952. So it's not like he has survived. He's beaten 16 other Republicans, but he's paid. He's taken some water on in terms of his credibility with the public.
When you look at the stories that you tell in this book and the various campaigns, is this the best we can do? Is this the best system that we can come up with in electing our leaders?
I think the presidential system, actually, as many complaints as people have about it, I think is actually not the most worrisome part of our system. The American system has always had a balance between kind of direct democracy and representative democracy. It was designed as a republic, not a direct democracy. There were worried, certainly you see in the chapter I have on 1824 about Andrew Jackson, the fear about a demagogue, the fear about putting too much power in one person's hands, and that fear directly connected to the passions of the people. I mean, the fear was that somebody would be, and in this case, a military hero, people would just get kind of all excited about him and put him in office and not think through how his temperament might clash against the necessities of the office or the necessities of politics. And so they wanted, constantly to have the voice of the people and then a break on that voice. That's essentially what the primary process does. The Democrats have a little bit more systematic process for that. But you have people who have a certain amount of power in the superdelegates who have the party's long-term interests at heart, who think about the candidates and whether they can win in the general election. And you in the Republican Party don't have that, but you definitely have people in the Republican Party right now who would love to have some superdelegates. Mitt Romney's made that case. Former Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels has made that case that they need a point of the process where people can say, hey, I know a lot of voters like Donald Trump, but we need to think about this in terms of a general election and can he win in a general election, not can he win among Republican voters, and find some way to weigh those voices towards the final decision. Now, in terms of the structural changes in our politics, money plays a huge role. That's at the presidential level, but also outside of it. The death of split ticket voting and the fact that people tend to live nearer to each other. Gerrymandering, which is important, though some people think it's the whole bundle. I think there's a series, it's a part of the mix for the system that isn't operating so well, but it's not the only thing. I think the interest groups that make money off of conflict. I think social media, which encourages the hottest reactions and basically causes anybody in the middle to kind of get out of the conversation because you have only the hottest of the left and the right debating in a format that encourages misunderstanding. I think all of those pieces of the system are actually pretty bad and harder to fix than the simple system for finding nominees for the parties.
The name of the book is Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History. It is published by 12. John Dickerson is the moderator of CBS's Face the Nation and political director of CBS News, as well as a columnist for Slate Magazine. John, thank you very much for joining us this morning. Best of luck with the book, and thank you for being here.
Thanks, Joe. I really enjoyed it.
Again, the name of the book is Whistle Stop, My Favorite Stories from Presidential Campaign History, published by 12. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.